Jim. You know, it's my great privilege to follow Frank as his chairman of the Academy's Board on Radioactive Waste Management. And I kept wondering yesterday, when questions were being directed to the two former commissioners, why they weren't identified as the two former chairmen of the, one former chairman of the Radioactive Waste, or the current chairman of the Radioactive Waste. I guess which you think is more important depends on if you're being regulated.
Chris, there's no question in their minds as to which is more fun.
Which is more fun? Well, I'll return to that at the end of the talk, where we have a weird coincidence in one of my slides with something Bill Kohlblazer quoted last night. But meantime, I want to jump into the subject that I was asked to speak about, which is natural and engineered barriers and their contributions to performance at Yucca Mountain. This topic has been one on which, and that has gotten a lot of mileage, and DOE has not figured out exactly how to apply. That is, the Nevada charge is that the Yucca Mountain project has fixed a bad site with elaborate engineering. And there's no doubt that elaborate engineering has been applied to the Yucca Mountain design. But the question of whether they fixed a bad site or whether they've just built confidence in the performance of the system, and that our expectations for the relative contributions were somewhat skewed in the early days, is what I'm going to address here. The next slide, please. All right. It's clear that when geological disposal was initially selected as the disposal path for high-level waste, that the mindset of those involved was that the rocks did the work, and that engineering was a temporary aspect of the performance of the system. And it may be it's self-selecting. When the initial work was begun at Yucca Mountain for site characterization, it was run by geologists, and they focused on geology. I remember I was on the waste board at the time, and I had an annual argument with Jerry Boak, who was running that work, which was, you guys ought to spend some money on engineering. And Jerry's point was, the engineering has to last long enough to get the stuff underground, but it's not going to be an important long-term barrier. I think with time, as we've been through the iterative risk assessment process, perceptions have changed. But I also think that Tom Cochran's comments yesterday about the 600-year period that was mentioned in the 1957 Academy report is very telling about what it is that people are focusing on when they talk about geologic isolation. Have the next slide, please. Well, let me not get ahead of myself. If you look at the Waste Act in 1982, it makes it clear that what it has in mind is geologic isolation. The guidelines for recommending a site, you know, should be detailed geologic considerations, is what the Act itself says. Next slide, please. I pulled out the 1991 TSPA, which was really the first Yucca Mountain performance assessment. They did iterations again in 93 and 95 and I guess 98 and so on. And the 91 one was kind of remarkable to go back to in hindsight, because it's simple enough that you can actually understand it, which has become an increasing problem with time as the complexity of the analysis has grown. But the modeling of the waste package in 1991 TSPA is simplicity itself. It's three parameters. It's a hot period at which the waste package, whatever it is dry, and therefore you don't get water-based corrosion, followed by an uncertain re-wetting period. And the net result is a long uniform distribution of container failures between 500 and 10,000 years, the mean of which is about 3,100 years. And that's it. That's the entire model for waste package failure. But the TSBA 91 notes that perhaps with more analysis, we would get a more sophisticated understanding of what contributions one gets from the package. It's also important to understand that in 1991, we were not dealing with a dose limit as a standard, but rather a containment requirement. And the focus in that analysis was whether gaseous releases of carbon-14 would exceed the allowable release limits. Next slide, please. Now, in trying to allocate credit between the engineered barriers and the natural barriers, you find you get a certain amount of double counting. If I wear a belt and suspenders and my pants stay up, who's to say if it's the belt and who's to say if it's the suspenders? And for most radionuclides that might be put into Yucca Mountain, either the natural system or the engineered barriers would be sufficient to contain those radionuclides through decay. In either case. The next slide. I pulled this out of the final environmental impact statement. And this is the inventory from the commercial spent fuel, which is about 90% of all the activity that's planned to go into the mountain. And as I mentioned, Tom yesterday pointed out the 600-year period needed to contain cesium and strontium. And that is clearly where the bulk of the activity of the high-level waste is. 7 billion plus curies out of a total of around 10. A few of the longer-lived ones, the plutonium-238, americium, and the other plutoniums, decay into longer-lived radionuclides, but when they do so, the mass is more or less conserved, give or take an alpha particle, but the amount of activity scales with a half-life. So when plutonium-238, for example, decays to U-234, the amount of activity you get is greatly reduced because the half-life of the uranium is so much longer. So what this shows is that is in the 1957 period, when you're thinking about high-level waste, it's dominated by the heat and the intense activity of the 30-year half-life fission products. And only now when we're into TSPA space, and only now when we're using calculations that go out to a million years, do some of the smaller contributors to the inventory, particularly the mobile isotopes of Tech-99, Iodine-129, become important. But if you're doing a quick and dirty pre-TSPA consideration of how the repository work, it will work quite well for things like cesium, which is a short half-life and it's sticky, tends not to move in the environment. Next slide, please. Now, the question of how the relative contributions stack up was the subject of presentations to the Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board in 2002. And I happened to have attended that meeting, and when I was asked to talk on this project, I called Peter and John and asked for copies of their slides. No sense to redo pretty complicated work that had already been done. And I think I got some very interesting insights from looking at the work those guys had done. Next slide, please. This is Peter Swift's slide. And it's somewhat complicated, but if you look at the steep black line on the left, that's what happens if you take the waste inventory with no cladding, no fuel matrix, no waste cans, and no mountain. Pretty much dump it in the park. You get very high doses for a short period until it's diluted. And then, as this slide shows, from the top down on the right, they start adding barriers. And the barriers dilute the dose and stretch it out in time. And if you notice the drop to the yellow barrier, that is a fairly major contribution, and that's what you get from the repository. I believe it's under the waste contribution from the unsaturated zone, and so on. And then the last ones at the bottom are from the waste package or from drip shields. But So the next slide, please. John Kessler did pretty much the same thing. One of the things he observed is that the order in which you add barriers affects what result you get and how you interpret it. So he simplified it and said, okay, let's just first put in all the engineered barriers and then let's put in all the natural barriers, the unsaturated zone, the saturated zone. And you see large drops from each contribution. But then the next slide shows that if you reverse the order in which you put in the barriers, you get a different perspective on which is important. The answer is both contribute quite a lot. All right. So I think the take-home message is that the natural system and the engineered barriers provide us with some redundancy and protection, which, given the uncertainties and the long time frames involved in repository performance, I think is quite a good thing, somewhat comforting. The initial focus on the geology was, I think, had a shorter mindset. I mean, back in the days when, or at least back in the early days of the repository program, there was some debate at EPA as to whether the standard would apply for 1,000 years or 10,000 years. We weren't thinking about, for the stability of the geologic period, which is what we're, the regulatory regime we're in now. And the other aspect that I've noticed as the TSPA has evolved is that it's easier to analyze the things you build than the mountain. You don't get to take the mountain apart and examine it pebble by pebble. So to some extent, the ability to characterize the system is uneven between the engineered barriers, which can be tightly specified, and the natural system, which is what it is. So, now, Bill Kultlaser read this quote last night, and I was sitting there thinking, what are the odds that out of the thousands of academy reports over the last 25 years, we would have picked the same quote? And I realized the odds are pretty good. Bill and I and George Hornberger were all on the board at that time. I believe this report was the first report I participated in as a member of the Radioactive Waste Board. But it shows that the Academy's long-standing practice of being rude to DOE but still being invited back to do it again has been in play for quite some time. Incidentally, just as an aside, I'll tell you what they did wrong, among other things, in that analysis, was they had a scoring system for the geologic setting, and you got points for remoteness from people, and you got points for favorable geochemistry, and so on. There were a number of attributes, and you added up the scores from all those things. And when you look at how that worked, you discovered that Hanford had quite favorable geochemistry, and the salt sites had horrible geochemistry. Well, the salt sites don't depend on geochemistry as a barrier. So to ding them because they don't have favorable geochemistry was a bogus way of doing it. And what the board said is you have to think about the performance of the system as it would work, and quit trying to subdivide it into components, some of which don't matter at some of the sites. So that was an interesting insight. Now, the next slide is to tell you that we've almost gotten back to where we started in terms of how long it is until we have a repository open. We were 10 years from having a repository in 1970. And I believe we're 10 years from having a repository in 2008, right? With some several excursions in the side. And I thought about adding a little box that shows Frank Parker takes over waste board in the early 80s and suggest maybe there was cause and effect there. I decided that the only cause and effect is that the realism of the estimates varies with time and with the observer. As Tom Isaac said yesterday, if you looked at the dashed line for the IRG, he said we knew we'd never meet 1998, but that was what the law said they had to do, and who were they to say they couldn't do it? Anyway, if we're lucky and things go well and the application goes in and NRC smiles on it, that last curve may not be too far from what happens, but only time will tell. Thank you all.